Ever wonder about concepts like the evil eye, or, you
Yeah.
know, stories of people doing amazing things, things that seem impossible?
Oh, absolutely.
Are they just folklore, or is there maybe something more going on? It feels like we're kind of wired to look for that stuff.
It does. And today we're taking a deep dive into a really fascinating text that tackles these exact questions head on.
Okay.
It looks at these ideas from a specific viewpoint, one rooted in ancient Jewish sources, you know, the Mishnah, Talmud, Midrash, and those foundational early commentators.
Right. So this source isn't just guessing. It's digging into what these core texts actually say about things like Ayin Hara, the evil eye, and similar ideas.
Exactly.
But it sounds like it's really zeroing in on where later beliefs, the ones giving power to other forces or people, might have, well, strayed from the original path.
That's precisely it. The source makes a strong case that many common ideas about magic or apparent miracles done by individuals, and even seeking help through intermediaries.
Yeah.
These are actually major deviations.
Deviations from what?
From the fundamental tradition believed to have been received by Moses at Sinai. And it doesn't mince words. It calls some of these later concepts magical fantasy.
Magical fantasy. Okay. So let's unpack this. We want to explore the source's argument, look at the evidence it pulls from these ancient texts, and really understand what this stark contrast means. You know, tradition versus magical fantasy. What does it say about power, about reality itself?
Well, the source acknowledges right away that, yes, Ayin Ra is mentioned in early texts. But it immediately asks the key question. Do later ideas that see it as some kind of independent magical force actually line up with the authentic tradition?
And the source's answer is a clear no.
A very clear no. As you said, it uses that strong phrase, a horrible magical fantasy.
Wow. Okay, that definitely gets your attention. So what's the bedrock? What's the Torah argument the source uses to push back so hard?
It leans heavily on a really powerful section in Deuteronomy chapter 13. This part gives a stark warning, doesn't it? About following a prophet or dreamer.
Right, even if they show signs and wonders.
Exactly. If their message tries to lead you away from God or the commandments, you don't follow.
And that very first verse in the passage is critical for the source's argument, isn't it? The one about observing everything commanded, don't add, don't subtract. Why is that so fundamental?
Because, as the source lays out, drawing on commentators like Miri and Rambam Maimonides.
The great Maimonides.
Right. They argue the Torah given to Moses at Sinai was complete. In its sufficiency, is the phrase used, it's seen as an eternal law for everyone, everywhere, all time.
So a real prophet can't just change things.
A true prophet, sent by God, cannot tell you to alter a commandment, even for a short time. Especially not if it involves something like idolatry. Doing that fundamentally contradicts the complete prophecy of Moses.
And this is where it gets maybe a bit mind-bending for some. The source highlights that Deuteronomy 13 says, even if this person performs amazing signs, things that seem impossible, like making the sun stand still.
Which seems like the ultimate proof.
Right. But you are commanded not to listen.
Precisely. Their prophecy is automatically false, just because it clashes with the established, unchanging Torah of Moses. The test isn't the miracle you see.
It's the message.
It's the message. It's loyalty to the core tradition. You have to reject them. The source even notes the verse specifies consequences for speaking falsely about God.
So the takeaway is crystal clear. The message is the real test, not the spectacle.
Exactly. And this leads right into another powerful claim the source brings up, citing Rambam again, this time from his Mishneh Torah. It might surprise quite a few people.
Okay.
Rambam describes sorcery and witchcraft as just words of falsehood and lies.
Just words.
He says flat out they don't affect anything.
Wait, they don't affect anything, but, I mean, history is full of people, even today, who absolutely believe they do. They do rituals, use charms, they incantations.
Yeah.
And they think they see results.
Right. But Rambam's view, as the source presents it, is that believing they're real or have power is, well, foolishness, or maybe a lack of deep understanding.
So why did the Torah forbid them?
Not because they wield some genuine competing power, but because they are fundamentally vanity and emptiness. They're a delusion, a distraction from the truth.
Okay, okay. This leads straight to the next big question, doesn't it? What about all those times people saw things happen, things that looked exactly like magic or like powerful acts done by people who weren't exactly on the right path? How does the source square that circle?
Yeah, the source dives right into that. It draws on explanations from figures like Rashi, Rabbi Yaakov Anatoly, and discussions in the Talmud. And their interpretation is really crucial here.
Which is?
When these apparent wonders happen through sorcerers or people deviating from the true path, It is not because they have any inherent power.
Okay. So who does?
It's God acting.
God. That's quite a statement.
Yeah.
Why would God make something look like a miracle happen through someone spreading a false message or using, you know, forbidden methods?
The source gives a couple of reasons based on these texts. One idea is that God might cause it to happen, sort of, to ensnare the wicked who are already seeking out these paths. It reflects that principle. In the path a person wishes to go, they are led.
Hmm. If you're looking for vanity, maybe God lets you find apparent vanity. That's challenging. What's the other reason?
The main one, really, is that God does it to test people.
Ah, back to the test.
Exactly. The source loops back to that verse in Deuteronomy 13 about the false prophet and the sign and quotes it. For the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul.
So the phenomenon isn't proof of the person's power.
Not at all.
It's the test itself. To see if your loyalty is truly with God and his unchanging command, or if you'll be swayed by the, you know, the flashy sign.
Precisely. And the source uses that classic example, right? Pharaoh's sorcerers in Egypt.
Their staffs turned into snakes, too.
They did. But Rabbi Yaakov Anatoly explains this wasn't their power. God caused it. And it served multiple purposes, maybe showing Pharaoh his own power, symbolized by the serpent, was temporary, especially when Aaron's staff swallowed theirs.
And maybe also to test Pharaoh further, make him think Moses was just another magician.
Could be. The source notes their actions were described using a word meaning in illusion or secret arts. It wasn't substance.
So the core principle here is perceived reality, even if it looks like a stone-cold miracle or super effective magic, always needs to be checked against the baseline truth of the Torah.
And the principle that only God has ultimate real power.
Right. If the message or the source of the phenomenon contradicts the Torah, then the signs don't matter. They're just part of the test.
That's the argument. And the source draws a very strong implication from this. Anyone involved in sorcery, incantations, using amulets for power, things like that, they're fundamentally operating on a false premise.
Relying on vanity and emptiness, as Rambam put it.
Exactly. Their actions, in this view, are essentially like the false prophet Deuteronomy warned about. The source even quotes Rambam saying that using verses like an incantation for healing instead of through prayer or natural means is forbidden. It misuses the Torah and falls under the umbrella of sorcery.
Okay. So beyond magic and signs, the source also tackles another related area, right? This idea of relying on, well, things that aren't God. Seeking help elsewhere.
Right. It gets into the whole concept of intermediaries. It cites Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah, Tractate Sanhedrin specifically.
And his fundamental principles of faith.
Yes, his fifth principle. Only God is to be worshipped and served directly. You must not serve or praise or even pray to anything lower in creation. Not angels, not stars, not the elements.
Why is that line drawn so sharply? I mean, most people wouldn't confuse an angel with God.
Because, as Rambam explains, they have zero independent control. They're just tools acting solely by God's will. Directing worship or service towards them shows a fundamental misunderstanding of your actual power and authority lie.
And this includes even trying to use them as, like, go-betweens, thinking you can ask an angel to take your message to God.
Absolutely. The source really emphasizes Rambam's direct statement, and one does not make them intermediaries to reach him. Full stop.
That's a core principle, then.
It's presented as absolutely core. Seeking help from created beings, even if you think you're doing it to connect through them to God, is forbidden. It's seen as a form of worship of others, essentially idolatry.
Wow. The source also mentions how this kind of thinking can sneak into even prayer itself, right? Criticizing the idea that prayer is about, what, bringing down abundance.
Yes, like you're manipulating some spiritual plumbing system. The source highlights this as a deep misconception.
So what is true prayer, according to this perspective?
It's about humbling yourself before God, recognizing total dependence on him, knowing that all blessings, all abundance, come only from him. No intermediaries needed, no manipulation possible.
And it brings that Mishnah example from Megillah, right, about prayer phrases.
Yeah, stopping someone from saying things like, may the good ones bless you.
Why? Seems harmless.
Because it implies duality. It suggests there are other powers besides God who can grant blessings. And the Mishnah calls that kind of thinking a form of heresy.
It all seems to circle back to the absolute unity and unique power of God. Any deviation, even subtle, is seen as a serious error.
That's the consistent thread, yes. Directing focus, worship, reliance, requests anywhere but solely and directly to the one God is the fundamental mistake.
Okay, this brings us back to the source's standard for truth. If our perceptions can be misleading, if even seemingly powerful acts or well-meant prayers can go wrong, how does the source say you know what's actually true and reliable? What's the anchor?
The anchor, overwhelmingly, is Masorah, the tradition.
The received tradition.
Exactly. The Torah given to Moses at Sinai is the unchanging benchmark, given once for all time. How we understand it, how we practice it, that's determined by the established tradition passed down faithfully, man by man, through the generations.
Which reminds me of that incredible story the source uses from the Talmud, Tractate Baba Metzaya. It's almost shocking.
Oh, the story of Rabbi Eliezer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's powerful. He's in this intense legal argument with the other sages.
And he pulls out all the stops. Uh-huh. Miracles.
Right. He makes a carob tree jump across the field, reverses the stream's flow, even makes the walls of the study hall start caving in, all to prove his legal point.
And when even that doesn't sway the other sages who are relying on their understanding of the traditional interpretation,
he calls for heavenly backup, a bat call. A voice from heaven declares, the law is according to Rabbi Eliezer.
I mean, what do you do with that? A voice from heaven.
And yet, the sages, led by Rabbi Yehoshua, they stand their ground. They reject it all. The miracles, the moving trees, even the heavenly voice, their reason.
It is not in heaven.
Exactly. Meaning, the authority to interpret the Torah, once it was given at Sinai, now resides with the sages here on earth. They have to work within the framework of the received tradition and establish principles of interpretation.
So the source quotes the Talmud saying you just don't listen to heavenly voices or look at miracles to decide the law.
Correct. The rule given at Sinai was clear. Follow the majority opinion of the sages, after the many to incline. And the Talmud adds that amazing detail. It says God sort of laughed and agreed, saying, my children have defeated me, validating their stance that the authority rests with the traditional process on earth.
So let's tie this back. If someone today claims a teaching is true because, I don't know, they had a vision, saw a miracle, got a message from an angel, The argument from this source, based squarely on these Talmudic principles, is you reject it. The standard isn't the experience, it's the authentic received tradition.
Precisely. That's the core message.
Yeah.
And building on this, the source goes into Rambam's incredibly strong condemnation of certain later books and practices that clearly went against this established tradition, even if they became popular in some circles.
Like those books describing God physically.
Yes. The source mentions Rambam's critique of works like Shir Koma, which tried to give God physical measurements. Rambam didn't hold back. He called them lies. Foolish, full of fantasies.
Written by?
By wicked, ignorant people whose ideas were swallowed by simple-minded, naive people.
That's really harsh language. Why such intense criticism? These sound like mystical texts to some.
The source explains Rambam saw them as dangerous corruptions of fundamental Torah principles. God's absolute unity, his incorporeality. Not harmless speculation, but something that undermined the very foundation of the true tradition.
To the point where Rambam said,
the source quotes Rambam saying that destroying such books and wiping out their memory is actually a mitzvah, a great commandment, because they lead people into falsehood. He also taught that any claimed holy names beyond the ones revealed in the authentic tradition used for power or incantations are just meaningless inventions. Nonsense.
The source also brings up a common counterargument, right? People saying, well, if Rambam had seen this later book or heard about Elijah visiting so-and-so.
Right, the idea that he would have changed his mind based on later developments or stories.
And the source's response.
Consistent with its whole argument.
Yeah.
Dismisses it as fantasies for the simple-minded. It just hammers home the point again. You learn and understand Torah through the established, received tradition, passed down authentically, not through personal stories, not visions, not claimed visits from prophets, no matter how pious the person seems. Relying on those things is considered a fundamental departure from how Torah truth is meant to be accessed and maintained.
It still seems, well, hard to grasp how ideas the source labels magical fantasy or even heresy could gain traction, sometimes even among people who seem very religious or learned, if the standard is supposed to be so clear. How does the source explain that? How do these errors creep in?
Well, the source definitely acknowledges human fallibility. It's realistic about it. It points out that even great sages like the Amoraim and the Talmud sometimes realize they'd made a mistake in understanding or ruling, and they admitted it.
Even Moses accepted correction from Aaron on a point of law.
Exactly. So the point isn't that great people can't err. The issue is refusing to admit the truth when it's shown or clinging to an error, especially one that deviates from the core tradition just because it's become popular or feels compelling.
So, if even the giants could make mistakes, it's maybe more understandable how, over generations, errors could slip in. Misunderstandings, mixing with outside ideas, new practices popping up without a solid basis in the Mizora, maybe fueled by some of those compelling stories or perceived phenomena we talked about.
That seems to be the implication. And the source highlights that some errors are particularly tricky, particularly subtle. It talks about the most difficult form of deviation, called Shithuff partnership.
Partnership.
Associating other powers or entities with God's unique absolute power. It's seen as especially dangerous because the person doing it often thinks they're still serving God, maybe just incorrectly, or using intermediaries they mistakenly think are okay.
Which makes it really hard to see the error, let alone repent from it.
Very hard.
Yeah.
And the source warns this subtle error can crop up even among people who seem very close to Torah, very learned or devout.
Wow.
It brings that really poignant verse from Jeremiah where God basically asks, what went wrong? What fault did your ancestors find in me that they walked away, chasing emptiness, and became empty themselves?
A painful question.
It is. The source comments on how sad it is when people leave the true path for vanity.
Yeah.
And it stresses that deviation isn't just about bowing to statues. Even the thought or belief that some other power, some entity, some method besides God's direct will and his Torah's path can really affect things for good or bad, that itself is considered a thought of heresy and foolishness from this perspective.
Okay, so if we try to distill the core message, the actionable takeaway from this deep dive, the source is arguing that these popular beliefs giving real power to magic, to specific people, to intermediaries, or any idea that clashes with God's absolute unity and the Torah's completeness, they're fundamentally mistaken. They're deviation. And this holds true no matter how popular they get, how convincing the stories are, or what strange things people think they see happening.
That's the powerful, and maybe for some, quite challenging message, yes. The source argues passionately for a return to what it sees as the foundational principles, total belief in God's sole power as the ultimate reality.
An explicit rejection of magic and intermediaries having any real independent power.
Right. And sticking firmly to the unchanging tradition of the Torah, given at Sinai, passed down through authentic Mizora, not through later stories, visions, or claimed phenomena.
It really pushes you, doesn't it, to critically look at your own beliefs, maybe things you've taken for granted, how you perceive reality, even practices that feel spiritual, and measure them against the standard, the unchanging received tradition, not just signs, not popularity, not even subjective feelings.
Exactly. And maybe the final thought to leave you with is this. In a world just flooded with information, with so many competing claims about spiritual forces, personal power, different paths, how does grappling with this specific perspective, the one emphasizing God's sole power and the primacy of received tradition, how does that influence how you try to discern what's true? And ultimately, where do you place your trust?